All right, we'll call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs, Finance Committee to order. Representative Hamilton moves the minutes of, where's my minutes? What day? March 2nd. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, today we have three things on our agenda for sure. First thing up will be a presentation in just a minute from Representative Anderson and his group. They asked to come and update us on what they're up to up in Sauk Center on a project that some of us had seen and some of us haven't, and someone's playing bagpipes. Who was that? Was that Doty?
No way would that be me.
Huh? Okay. We're just looking for money for our coffee jar, so if that was a cell phone... Well, we're looking for a buck from someone. All right. And then after that, we'll get a quick report on where the Next Gen Energy grants went, and we'll end with a bill of mine on livestock liens. There is someone, if we have time, that wants to testify on any of the budget stuff they've heard so far. Again, I'll update members later on in the meeting on where I think we're at on that, and we're not moving very fast on anything at this point. So with that, Representative Anderson, welcome to your committee, and let us know what you're up to today.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Really appreciate the chance to have this time today to visit with you about a unique project up in the Sauk Center, which is in Stearns County on I-94. And it's a unique project because the facility is already there. It's a girls' home that was shut down back in the 90s. It was a prison for a while, or corrections facility, and now it's sitting empty. Just a 135-acre facility, just an excellent facility. And some folks back there are trying to find a niche and a place for military veterans and their families. So it's a unique story. They're not asking for money. So just sit back, and for the next couple of minutes, we have a CD to show you something about the facility. And with me today are Dallas Flynn and Jim Kohlhart from the facility, and welcome to them, and they will take over now. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and as you speak, introduce yourself and your name so we have it for the tape.
Chairman Dunkey, Jim Kohlhart from Valley Forge Village in Sauk Center, Minnesota.
I'm Dallas Flynn. From Frazee, Minnesota. I'm a farmer and researcher in vegetable gardening.
All right.
And Chairman Junkie, if we can just start off with this tape, I think that that will be more than relevant for the next 6 minutes. Just pay attention to this, if you will, please.
All right.
Now we know where the big pips are.
In the heart of central Minnesota, there is a convergence that can only be described as divinely guided. Our story begins in Sauk Center, Minnesota. In 1911, the Sauk Center Homeschool for Girls was established to provide care, training, and education for girls who did not fit into the community. Girls were taught skills such as farming, cooking, woodworking, and sewing, skills that would help them become productive citizens. Architect Clarence H. Johnston Sr. took a long-term view of this facility and incorporated colonial and classic revival elements into the buildings. The entire facility was not only practical, it had a grandeur and beauty rarely seen in care facilities. The property included an administration building, a hospital, a chapel, farm buildings, and cottages to house 160 girls. The school was closed in 1999. The land, which had a glorious purpose for nearly 90 years, sank into a state of waiting for a new purpose, so it could rise up and fulfill an even greater potential. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that a quarter of the nation's homeless are veterans. Returning troops suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and heightened levels of anxiety, all of which can lead to substance abuse, Many of them are unprepared to integrate back into the world they left. The invisible wounds of war can continue for years, even if a veteran returns with his or her life. In 2008, the RAND Corporation published a 10-year study on post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and depression among veterans. Their recommendation? Delivering the necessary care would pay for itself in 2 years and even begin saving money due to increased productivity and decreased health care costs. There is a desperate need for veterans to receive not just health care, but whole care. Care of the body, mind, and spirit. Care that includes families of veterans. Care that teaches new, marketable skills in a rapidly changing workplace. Care that places optimal health and happiness at its foundation. Nadia McCaffrey had a son. After September 11th, Patrick, a middle-aged father of two, felt called to fight for his country. He died while tending to his friends, a casualty to the Iraq War. Nadia was determined to honor his death by helping returning veterans. She envisioned a place where they could be healed with simple things, such as nature, silence, working the land, and spending time with their families. She heard of the Sauk Center property and paid a visit. The vision became clear. Here was a place of such beauty, the natural beauty of the wilderness, the beauty of a clear Minnesota lake, the beauty of multiple buildings, lovingly designed and steeped in the energy.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the problem is here. We have technical help on staff here, but...
Aren't you a technical expert there, Representative Anderson?
That's what kids are for.
I see. Yeah, technology's great when it works.
But as you can see, the facility is there. It's right now being not used, and these gentlemen have some ideas and a plan that could utilize this facility in a therapeutic way for veterans and their families. And Dallas, why don't you go ahead and talk about some of the things you're looking at?
Well, I'm a vet that came back from Vietnam, but I was one of the lucky ones. I came back in 1963, so you can see how old I am. After college, I had factories in China, the Dominican Republic, and in Detroit Lakes. When I retired at the age of 50, I went into gardening, and I love to garden. I've always gardened. I hated it when I was a kid, but I love it now. And I do a lot of research on tomato production. For example, my cucumbers on a 20-foot row. 2 years ago, I picked a little bit over 1,400 pounds of cucumbers. We do a lot of high tunnels. You maybe have heard about the high tunnels, the plastic structure. We grow tomatoes. Example, a tomato plant outside will give you 5 to 8 pounds of potatoes. We run 50 pounds of potatoes. I mean tomatoes, I'm sorry. And we had nothing when I come back. And it took some of us quite a while to kind of get our stuff put back together. But what I want to do is I want to help Valley Forge Village with the area of vegetable production, fruit trees, fruit production. That's where my love is. That's where my goal is. I do work with the University of Minnesota on cucumbers and tomatoes, Minnesota Department of Ag on season extension. We've taken a 90-day growing season, and we are currently growing between 270 and 300 days a year. A week ago Monday, we ate our last tomatoes from last year. And I want to bring these skills that I have to Valley Forge Village.
Representative Junkie Jim Colthard here. one of the things that we've done is we've partnered up with different groups of people to pull this in, and the handout that I have is one of them is the Farmer Veteran Coalition, which when I first heard about them, I didn't think much of it. When I first went out to California to meet Nadia McCaffrey and take a look at what they were doing, I was stunned by the success that they were having working with returning Iraq and Afghan veterans. And they have really opened my eyes to this portion of this project, and that's what we wanted to come present to today. Was there is kind of a big movement inside of a lot of these different agencies across the country about really kind of returning to an old belief that we had about these type of communities, whether it be in prison settings or like the Minnesota Homeschool or even the old VA systems, or, you know, a lot of this stuff was very relevant 100 years ago, and we've found that it's very relevant today to bring this stuff back for many different reasons. So the partnership that we have with the Farmer Veteran Coalition and their expertise around this, and then being able to have Dallas join our board of directors to provide the Minnesota connection with this, we're real excited about what really can happen on this property as far as creating jobs and stuff. No, the one thing that I would like for you to take a look at, that we see that this project is, and I've been using the word ever since I heard the term more than shovel ready, is what I've been calling this, that if you'll take a look at the next to the last page, you'll see all the work that has been completed, that if you were to start from scratch and have to start and get these things done, it would cost a ton of money, and it would take a long, long time to go through these. And then as far as the employment that it would create by bringing this on board, we feel that this is kind of like a skeleton that what we would need by the time that what we envision a couple of years down the line, there would be a lot more employment than just this 126 people that we see that doing this would create. We're looking at this as a national model. We're not looking at it as a medical model. The rest of the tape shows pictures of using St. Cloud, Minneapolis, Fargo, Sioux Falls, using the community-based outpatient clinics. One of the things, I used to run MACV, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and I've been in front of you before whenever we was getting money for MACV. And also did the housing project that where you guys gave me the bonding money to build the Al Lair Veterans and Community Housing up in St. Cloud on a VA campus up there, and the Veterans Community Housing in Minneapolis, where I built 140 units of permanent housing on a VA campus there and 60 units there. And those have all been very good dollars, well-spent dollars, to help single adults. And what we're envisioning here is really a total community approach. Veterans, military people, there are veterans that are on duty that need to be able to kind of pull out and utilize a place like this where they feel very welcome, that they can go live what we picture it being short-term, long-term. We picture it being a place where we took the RAND study recommendations about how to treat these new things, and we incorporated into our ability to do that using evidence-based outcomes. We've partnered up with a Mayo Clinic that they would provide evidence-based outcomes of what we're going to do along with what somebody else was going to do. We've partnered up with Larson Allen, the audit people that kind of oversee that any of the contracts and things that we put together are really everybody's okay with what takes place. So we feel we've put together a good partnership, a good leadership team that I feel very proud of, pulling these different coalitions together, and we're generating everything but money for this, you know. So You know that story probably better than I do, but you know, it's coming, it's happening, and you know, really, I guess our ask and want from you folks is to really understand the story, so that when you hear something about it, you can say, well, I don't think that's what's happening. You know, we're not in competition with the veterans' homes. We're not in competition with the VA. We're not trying to say they're not doing their jobs or anything like that. We're just hoping to add to it. And if you notice, you know, one of the things that we picture is a place for Gold Star mothers. And if you saw, we were lucky enough to see the picture of Nadia and Senator Becky Lurie, whose son was killed there. It was Gold Star mothers, and that was Mary Tillman, the third one, Pat Tillman's mother. That there's this different group of mothers out there that are really kind of behind this whole idea of having a national center where they feel very welcome, that they know that they can get somebody there. So we're not looking at this as a local cure, fix, or anything like that. So we're looking at this as somebody wants to go to Harvard, they go out east. If you want to go to Hazleton, you go to Center City. And we're looking at this as the same way, that if somebody wants that this place, that they come to Sauk Center, Minnesota for this. So we see it as nothing but a win-win-win, but we also know win-win-win, the font size for win for everybody at the table is not the same. But I think it's a very big win for our group of people that we're hoping to serve. So thank you for this time.
All right, a few things. Number one, welcome to Senator Gimsey. He's here, and he's the Senate counterpart to Representative Anderson and myself, but this is in his district, too, so he's got a keen interest and joined us in the audience. Who just update me on this a little bit. I've been there. A lot of the members here, we were there on a part of our Ag and Veterans tour here about 3 years ago. We came through, and I came through again at the bonding committee. Remind us, who owns this now? Who owns the facility?
The property is owned by Jim Joust in, up in, he's from Duluth area, who he runs a couple of chronically inebriate places up there, and that was his original intention when he bought the place, was to do that on a board and lodging place.
So it's his intent to sell this property?
Sell it or to utilize it. You know, he is very willing to work with anybody, and you know, he's bent over backwards as far as I'm concerned as somebody that wants to see this happen in this way. You know, he's broken the property up, and he's got it where if he had to have a fire sale to sell it off and just get his money back, he could do that.
And the last time I was up, he was trying to sell off some of the lakeshore, and that, has he done any, accomplished any of that?
Well,
is that all one unit yet?
I don't think he has any of the lakeshore. I think the lakeshore was by the original owners, my understanding, that they developed that lakeshore.
Is there access to the lake?
Yes, there is. There is two lots that stream from the property onto the lake.
Yeah. How many housing units would be there?
Well, right now we figure 200 or 220, depending upon what. But that's only for single adults.
So 200 plus, probably,
yes,
for single adults. And so you're, looks like you're, and again, your plan is progressing and morphing and growing, I guess, since I've been there last. I think it's interesting, the agriculture aspect you brought into it. How many tillable acres are out there that you could utilize?
I think that they're looking at 33 right now. Is that right?
Yes, there's about approximately 30 acres, 30-35 acres.
Okay. Well, I think it's an interesting concept, and to get the update on it, there are a lot of needs, as I discover, too, for, you heard yesterday from Lutheran Social Services, who are kind of experts in mental health care and treatment, and what they talk about is if you bring them into a hospital or a facility that's that treats PTSD or TBI or other chronic mental illness, when they leave, many times they need transitional housing. They're not ready to just go home, but they transition into kind of a halfway setting, which I foresee that's maybe one of your visions as that could be used. And then certainly you're looking at a place for homeless vets to go and maybe be reintegrated or retrained or get their hands dirty in the field and learn a little farm trade or those types of things. Is that what your, I mean, what would the mix of the 200 people look like someday if this was open?
Well, I my personally hope that we end up having around 400 at the end of the at the end product. And how I envision that is veterans like myself and my wife, as we wind down our lives, by some outside perimeter. We've lined it out where we could have like 91 story places for elderly. I picture being able to, a lot of veterans have money that they could pay rent. I see some rental income. I see some ownership. I see some condominium, some planned unit development type stuff. I see the short-term transitional housing. That's where we felt we would start just because of the need. People said, okay, what do we need and what is the VA has said they're going to try to eliminate homelessness in 5 years is what, when I was out in Washington this spring, they asked us, well, for us to do that, what are we going to have to do? And I said, then you're going to have to just make it easier for us to operate. That if you will remove a lot of the restrictions and timelines for us, we can do a lot of these things. But when we're caught up in this kind of slowly getting there, there are a lot of places around the country that are sitting around like this. And the for me, what I love about this project, Sauk Center has really gotten behind this. I have, you know, whenever I was trying to do the housing in Minneapolis and St. Cloud and in Minneapolis, all the NIMBY issues that I ran against all the time, it is not there. They really want to see this happen. And I think part of the reason they want to see it happen is they like that mix of families, women and children, that it not just be homeless who are coming through, that they see it being a portion of it. That, and I see it from a clinician's point of view and a somebody who's worked with people before, of the healthiness of that, of you don't have just one population in need. You have the full spectrum of people. So that's kind of the end product that I envision that I've tried to lead this organization.
And finally from me, maybe you can update what you're hearing in Washington. Obviously, you know, members, I've been sitting here for 3 years trying to figure out what veterans and agriculture have to do with each other. But now I learned today there's a farmer-veteran coalition. So that's interesting. Yeah. See, we're not the only ones that had that idea of putting those together. But certainly in D.C., you've got some people well-placed. I don't know who's on Veterans Committee. I know Walls is. I don't know if Klein is. You know, and you got two senators out there, obviously. You certainly have a chairman. Does Colin represent you in Sauk Center, or is that Obasa? It's Colin. So, I mean, you have a chairman of the Ag Committee with USDA money available and rural economic development money available. What kind of sense are you getting? Have you been in those offices in D.C., and are you brainstorming with them? And I assume you're looking for some federal assistance on this from federal VA or USDA or some such thing.
When what we've met all around. My first try at this is that I want outside money. I didn't want to really get involved with federal or state dollars. If we could find the money to do it with the outside and then partner up with these agencies, I felt that would be the quickest way we could move. That hasn't happened. And so what's happened is Dallas met with Secretary Vilsack.
I spent 2 weeks ago, I spent about half an hour, 45 minutes with Secretary Tom Vilsack and Colin Peterson. Super people. And I always remind Colin Peterson that he did a good job when he used to do my income tax. So that kind of helps a little bit. But Vilsack, unbelievable guy, unbelievable man. Just very much behind us. I was able to present him packets of our program. Also, I would like to mention that my wife is a physician, and she sits at the VA center in Alexandria. And I asked her the other day, I says, what's it looking like? And she just kind of shook her head. It's sad out there, folks. There's a lot of hurting people. A lot of hurting people. And
okay, it's well, good. So you are making those contacts.
Yes, sir.
Representative Schimansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to both of you gentlemen, you know, thank you for bringing this issue forward. It's something that, you know, I thought for a long time, if we could get our homeless veterans, you know, out of the lifestyle that they're in and, you know, kind of in a rehabilitation mode. Do you anticipate that as this moves forward that the participants in the program would be working at this site, and, you know, helping build it, if you will, not just, you know, being residents, but, you know, caretakers, co-owners of the property, in essence, you know, investing their time and efforts into it as well.
Mr. Coulthard.
Yes, sir. I envision those type of things taking place, but, you know, that is one of those areas where you really start running into some obstacles, you know, of like if who follows the funding? If somebody's paying for it themselves and they come in there and they do that, you're okay. But it's like the minute that you really kind of start crossing the line of like if you're hiring somebody and you're letting them, it's the kind of nightmare that you really just get caught up in because it's such a good idea and you think there's no problem to it and somebody volunteers to do it and then all of a sudden you're up against some employment laws or you're up against some contractual laws. And the compensated work therapy program that's inside the VA is what I envision would be probably the best way to let something like that happen, was if partnering up with them to let that happen through their compensated work therapy program at the site. But having said that, I do think that part of that planned unit development ought to be a part where a person can buy into the place, that you buy a share, you can buy part of this project. And that's kind of what I had originally hoped, that we could find enough money to buy it, get it up and get started, that people could buy into it and say, I want to work there, I want a job, I want to earn my keep, I want to share the pie.
All right. Sure. Anyone else have any questions on this? Otherwise, we appreciate the update, and we appreciate the work and vision of you folks. I mean, it is a living and growing project, no question. It's something you could have set aside, like you say, a number of years ago, and it's kind of like the legislative process. You learn some of these things take a number of years, but with your dedication, I'm going to guess something's going to happen there eventually. So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
We'll move on as soon as they clear there to the Next Gen Energy Report. Ms. Connolly, I believe, is here. The members, you have a packet on that in your file. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christina Connolly, Biofuels Manager with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. You asked that we come here today to give you a brief update on the Next Gen Energy Board and its 2010 legislative report. The Next Gen Energy Board was established by the governor in 2007 to develop recommendations and build consensus for the development of the next generation of biofuels in the state. The board is comprised of 20 members consisting of state legislators, state commissioners, and representatives from relevant industry, academia, and nonprofit sectors. The board's primary focus is to examine the use of the state's resources to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels, to increase our homegrown energy sources, and work towards agricultural and natural resource sustainability and economic vitality. In 2009, the board met three times and then once again recently in January of 2010. Those meetings covered a number of topics, from updates on stimulus dollars coming to Minnesota, updates on work from AURI and the Institute for Renewable Energy and the Environment at the U, and updates from our NextGen grantees. In August, board members also took a trip up north and visited energy project facilities in Benson, the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company, as well as the facility at the U of M Morris. By law, each year the NextGen Board must provide a report to the legislature by February 1st of each year. And this year's report is similar to last year's reports in the past. It provides an overview of the board as well as some information on recent meetings and then updates on past recommendations and appropriations, including the NextGen Energy Grant Program. In 2008, the NextGen Board awarded approximately $2.7 million in grants to 8 advanced energy projects across the state. These projects really ranged from a feasibility study for the first commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol facility in Minnesota, a small-scale gasification project using turfy biomass to produce electricity, studies on perennial energy crops and forest biomass sustainability, a pelletizing demonstration project, and a number of others. In general, these projects are progressing, but due mostly to the economic situation in Minnesota, several are unlikely to finish within their existing grant contract time frame, which right now ends on May 1st of this year. Others have requested different changes to their contracts in order to try and meet their goals. And because of this, one of the new things in this year's report is a recommendation from the board that the legislature extend the NextGen grant period for all grantees for a period of 1 year through FY11. This recommendation was also included in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations, and bill language is currently being drafted by Department of Ag and the Minnesota Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. The report, you have it with you, so I won't go into many of the other updates on recommendations unless you have any questions on any of them.
Okay, just looking at your report, maybe you can help us out without going through all of them. Is there anything that we need to do this year, language-wise or policy-wise or I know money-wise, we all like to do that, and we've got some problems on that end. But, I mean, I'm looking through the report, members. You'll see a lot of recommendations, and they say in progress or suspended or complete, et cetera. Is there some right on the top of your head that you would say, yeah, can we, it's something we could do for in one of our bills this year or to facilitate anything that you need done?
I would say just this grant extension, which the action item is on page 9.
Okay. So that's something we need to do statutorily at this
point. Right. Otherwise, the grants will end on May 1st.
Okay. I think members understand the board is recommending that while we would wish that all the grants would be out and working, that with the economy and the credit markets and other things the way they are, some of these projects have gotten pushed back a few months and may go over that deadline. I don't think it's a sense of us to move them back indefinitely, but just to extend them another year or some such thing. And we'll certainly look at that as we put bills together here. And certainly the other thing is, obviously, when you see that where the $2.5 million went, these are good projects. We hope in the future, again, to revive some of the grants. So the board will continue to operate to just keep monitoring and understanding what's coming in our next-gen energy biosphere, if you will, out in rural areas so that we're ready to go whenever we do have resources available. So I think that's still an important item for the board to meet and discuss, see presentations, take the tours. But certainly another part is then looking into the future with some of those technologies and hopefully giving out some of these grants that can help some of these startups move along. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3 of your report, Ms. Connolly, at top paragraph, it says, lower down, it says, producing 25% of the state's ethanol from cellulosic materials by 2015. Is that goal on target? Or are we still moving in that direction?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is just a goal. I think we are moving in the right direction with one of our projects. The one that received the most funding is the Central Minnesota Cellulosic Ethanol Partnership, and this is the one that is doing a feasibility study to partner with the existing ethanol plant in Little Falls and become the first cellulosic plant in Minnesota It would be starting at a 10 million gallon per year plant, but with plans to ramp up in the future, and so I do think that Minnesota is moving forward with that goal.
Representative Schmitz.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because it says here Minnesota continues to lead with mandates, 20% ethanol by 2013, and the goal, again, of the 25% from cellulosic materials. Do we know what it's going to cost to produce a gallon of cellulosic ethanol yet?
Ms. Connolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there are a number of estimates out there. I think off the top of my head I wouldn't want to give you one, but I can get back to you on that.
Thank you. Representative Schmansky. That's it. All right. I got a question. I'm going to put you on the spot because you wouldn't know this question was coming, but I got a note this morning from someone that tells me that South Dakota has $1 million going out in ethanol blender pump grants that they got from federal stimulus dollars. Did we think to do anything like that here in the state, either through you or through DEED or interagency of with the stimulus dollars we have gotten? Again, I probably most of it over in DEED and other things. I know there's, I believe South Dakota used some of their energy stimulus dollars, and they're awarding, I think, $1 million in grants for blender pumps. That was announced just recently, passed the legislature out there. What can we do, or what are you doing, or have you thought about trying to access some of those funds for some of these biofuel uses? I think our blender pump need is great in this state right now. We've done good with E85 pumps, and we lead the nation, but the next generation, as you know, is blender pumps. So have you tracked any of that, our surrounding states? Did you know South Dakota did that? And are they just smarter than us, or did we figure something out too?
Mr. Chair, I did hear about that, and I have been watching the stimulus dollars. Most of what came to Minnesota went through the Office of Energy Security, and we did look early on into opportunities for biofuels. But more recently, there have been discussions about blender pumps, especially as we look towards this goal that's approaching of 20% ethanol in the state. That will be an issue, is the availability at the pump. But at this time, we don't have stimulus dollars directed towards that.
And all the energy dollars have been, are they out the door, do you know? I mean, I know it's not your department, but you interface with them. Do you know if that's all been spoken for that we got?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it's all been spoken for. Whether it's actually all been paid out, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, it's something to keep thinking about, members. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I strongly concur with your statement about blender pumps. I drive out of my way if I can find a blender pump, and I think the research shows that E30 is maybe the best mileage we can get. We need to get going on blender pumps, so I strongly agree.
Right. Yeah, we had the report here. One in Mankato and North Dakota have done the research. Somewhere between E20 and E30 you actually get better mileage than E0. And so as our environmental community tends to interface with us on ethanol a lot, that's one of the positives we can bring them, besides clean air and all the other good things we bring them, is we can improve the fuel economy of our fleet if we had blender pumps at more stations in Minnesota. So, but right now I think that fund, and by the way, that's something that I have staff looking at. We do have, even when we have money, we've got to make sure that it's eligible for blender pumps now. We have the E85 pump, and we may be doing that in our legislation this year, too, is changing. So that's, if we get money, it's available for blender pumps, too. Any other questions on the Next Gen report? Otherwise, you've got it, and certainly read through it. And if there's anything anyone thinks we should do legislatively from the department or the members, let us know. All right, thank you. Moving right along, I'm going to move House File 2889 before the committee, and it's my bill, and I'm also going to move members a delete everything amendment, the DE2 amendment, to get it in the order I want before we start the discussion. So to that DE2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Now it's in the order we want. Members, this bill, and we have a number of people want to come up and testify, so I'm not going to take much time to let them tell their story, was brought to my office and this committee by the pork producers and the grain and feed associations. Basically, here's the gist of the bill and the reasoning behind it. We have in the past year had some tough times on some livestock operations, whether it's in this case pork or dairy operations. Certainly that could create some problems. We've run into apparently some situations. I don't think they've ever come to the end point, but we've come to some situations where bankers or banks had been reluctant. Once someone files for mediation and they know then that they're in huge financial straits, that they worry about continuing to feed out that livestock for the next 30 or 45 days or whatever it ends up being, even though that's probably the one asset the bank has. So, I mean, to the bank's credit, I think most bankers understand that they would extend credit and feed out those animals so they can get them to market. But there have been cases where there's been some reluctance to do it. And I guess to avoid any confusion in the future, we think, or at least I think, as the bill's author, but in conjunction with the others, that this is not a bad thing to do. It would probably avoid some nasty phone calls between these groups and farmers and bankers. But again, to the credit, I'm not aware of any bank that hasn't done this, but I know there's been some situations that have been close. This bill simply allows gives the bank the opportunity to extend that credit to feed out the animals, and the elevator then gets a position to get paid for that feed is what it is. And we think it's a good idea. I've had my local bankers in, and as many of you have over the last few weeks, the groups have been in. I particularly asked two of my banks that do farm lending out there what their thoughts on this were. They were at first confused. They thought that we were giving the grain elevators a carte blanche position on the entire feed bill. So if a farmer was 6 months in the rears, that now they'd have the positioning on that entire feed bill and be liable for it. But that is not the case. This bill is only from that mediation point forward. So anything that's in the rears is still the bank has a position on that and everything else. My bankers at least said, well, that makes sense, and we have no problem with it if that's all the bill's doing. So the delete everything amendment came before you after some work with the bankers. Farm Credit, I know, had a bunch of people in for a meeting, and Mr. Appitz, we appreciate continuing work. I'm not going to tell you they're all gloriously on board with this bill, but I think it makes the bill fairly palatable to them, and we've taken their advice and put it into these amendments, and again, in the scope of trying to work with everyone. So that's the bill. I think we'll get some testifiers up here, and we got another amendment. Is that in our file? Okay. Mr. Sullivan, what are you doing to muck up my bill?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the A1 amendment is an amendment to the DE2. It's a technical amendment that I noticed this morning. I feel it's necessary to amend a similar statute that provides a definition for agricultural lien to add the new temporary livestock production input.
All right. I'll move the A1 amendment, again, to get the bill in the order that we need. Any discussion on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That's adopted. Now we have Laura Lemke, I believe, in place of Bob Zelenka that you see on your schedule. So introduce yourself, who you represent, and give us a testimony on this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Laura Lemke, and I'm representing the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association this morning. The Minnesota Grain and Feed Association represents the country grain elevator and feed mill industry in the state of Minnesota. We are pursuing a bill that would give feed mills a temporary priority lien for feed provided on credit to livestock producers who are undergoing mediation with their lenders. We are pursuing this legislation because, in our view, there is no incentive to keep feeding the livestock unless there is some form of security that allows the feed mill to get paid for providing feed to keep these animals alive or helping them reach market weight during mediation negotiations. To give you a few numbers, in the last 2 years, 62% of mediation cases have been livestock related. Between 2008 and 2009, there's been a 55% increase in mediation filings, and mediations are up 59% from last year at this time. This means that the problems are not going away soon. In surveying our own members, over 88% of feed mills are saying that they are having trouble getting paid on time from their livestock producers purchasing feed from them. Over 88% have also been forced to write off feed credit transactions because of a producer's inability to pay the feed bill. Those same feed mills have written off feed transactions in excess of $96,000 annually. That is a hard pill to swallow for a feed mill. The bill, with its amendments, represents a compromise between the association and the lenders. It allows the producers to stay in business while going through mediation, and ultimately, it improves the collateral or the livestock while mediation proceeds.
All right, any question to the elevator folks? And again, just to emphasize, even if they're in the rears to your people, this is only to finish the animals out from the point of mediation forward. It has nothing to do with that in the rears bill that you may have already incurred.
Correct.
All right. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and we've kind of helped guide some of this. And basically, if you look at the mediation law, it's been around since the mid-80s, there is a time period in the front end of mediation of approximately 45 days in which you're actually not kind of into mediation as such. And if you were to pull out that statute, you'll find that there's a time period in which you... The bank or the farm credit or who else it might be at that point in time files to get mediation under mandatory mediation. And then there's a 14-day time period in which the farmer has to determine whether or not they want to request mediation. Mediation delays, I believe, for 90 days the right to foreclose. And that's the time period we're talking about. And so once that request for mediation comes, then there's another 10 days for the mediator to set up the initial mediation meeting. So the point is, you're out at a very minimum of 30 days, and because of some court-supervised mediation provisions in there, you might be out as much as 45 days before you're actually into a situation where another provision in the mediation law would take over. And that provision is a obligation of good faith. In the existing mediation law, there is a provision that says that the creditor, the lender, is obligated for good faith purposes to provide necessary living expenses for the farmer during the period of mediation up to $1,600. And in addition, it is an obligation of good faith to maintain paying for the feed during that time to keep the livestock going. What we're dealing with here is the portion prior to that first meeting, for the most part. And that is the portion in which you're actually not into mediation, but you're in the process of getting there. At the time that that process starts, one of the first things that happens is that the state mediator sends out a notice to all people that are affected by the mediation, and that includes both secured and unsecured creditors. In the case of a feed mill, as an example, they probably are in an unsecured crediting position. So our concern is, in this bill, as much as we like our feed people to get paid, that is not our primary objective. Our primary objective is to maintain that the livestock is being fed during that time period until there is a resolution to the mediation. And so we're dealing with that first time period in which you're technically not into mediation yet, but the process has started. And the feed dealer, for instance, at that time would be notified that you're in a mediation. Once this happens, it is clear that the farmer is being foreclosed upon. When that becomes clear, it's kind of like rats off the ship sometimes, that people are very concerned about the fact, I'm not going to continue delivering feed because I'm not going to get paid. What this provides is a temporary first position lien, or at least a position that goes ahead of the credit of the lender, for the feed that's being delivered. And it is only for the unpaid feed delivered during that 45 days of mediation. So I want to make that very clear. It does not go ahead of anything prior to the mediation starting. It does not pay for anything after the obligation of good faith and so forth is kicked into gear, if that is the direction that they go. I would like also to point out that it does not require that the lender must continue to pay. If they determine that for whatever reason they do not want to, then what it does is basically say, okay, fine, the lender's not going to pay for the feed, get out of the way, and let the feeder, feed mill as such, get a lien on the livestock to pay for the feed during the mediation period. And that really, Mr. Chairman, is the gist of what the whole thing is about.
Okay, questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schoenfeld, just a point of clarification, say those pigs were 60-pound pigs. There was a couple comments about this would be to finish the pigs to market. If there was some type of resolution where you could find another farm that could actually take those pigs, this doesn't prohibit these pigs to be transferred off into somebody else's guidance, custody, whatever the case may be, does it?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't prohibit it, but you probably better than anybody on this committee knows the problems with disease and so forth. And you also probably know better than anyone that most farms today are set up on schedules that deal with certain sizes of pigs coming in and certain sizes of pigs leaving. The opportunity to make those transfers generally is pretty remote between different owners. And so the likelihood is that if they had to be transferred, they're going to end up at a sales yard, in which case the price of the value of those animals is going to be significantly reduced from their real value. And I guess since you asked the question, Representative Hamilton, Mr. Chairman, perhaps you could verify what I'm saying as someone that deals in this. Because, yes, there's nothing that says they couldn't, but the realities of the way the system generally works would make that probably a bad decision for everybody around, all the way around.
Hog expert Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand the reality around it. I know I just wanted clarification on that as well and let everybody else understand the reality. Thank you, Chair, or Mr. Schoenfeld.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Hamilton's example of a feeder pig being taken to market, could there be an example or situation where the value of the feed exceeds the value of the livestock, and then what happens? Can they stop delivering feed if that is thought to be the case?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it is certainly the case where the value of the feed could exceed, let me be careful how I state this. The value of the feed delivered during the mediation period probably is unlikely to exceed the value of the livestock. But if you read in the statute, there is a provision that basically speaks to the acquisition price of the livestock. The best example I can use is a feeder pig, because it's a short-term thing. Cattle are the same, but a little different. Let's suppose I purchased a feeder pig for $40 at 40 pounds, and I normally would finish that out at 220 pounds. When it's finished out, if I'm getting 40 cents a pound, as I think markets have been in the last year or so, I'm going to get $88 for that animal. The difference between the acquisition price and the sales price is spoken to in the statute that already exists. And what it talks about basically is the acquisition price is the $40, the sales price is the $88. The $44 in between is the most that could be available for a feed lien or an ag input supplier's lien. However, it would actually be less than that, because there has been feed that this only applies to unpaid feed during that period of time. Could the feed mill take a bath because there isn't enough money to go around? Certainly. Just as the bank would in a situation that you're into under mediation.
So again, it's only for that 45 days, not any previous bill they may have, and certainly want a lien, but probably don't have a lien on that. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, and now I want to bring our friendly banking community up. Mr. Appitz, so you get to start out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I represent Farm Credit Services here at the Capitol, and appreciate the time before the committee. Very kind of you. And typically, Jerry and I are on the same side of most issues, so he is more than a worthy adversary, so be kind with me, would you?
Please.
Anyway, let me just say, first of all, going into this, that we were lenders were frankly quite surprised at this piece of legislation because we're talking about the collateral that pays for our loan or that's used to pay for our loan. And as the chairman said, and I think he was very clear in articulating that, unless there's a very good reason, unless the lender has some pretty darn good reason, there would be no incentive to waste that collateral. Let the livestock die, not put the feed out there. And frankly, I think this bill generated out of some other concerns in the supplier industry that was honed down and refined it quite a bit. That said, apparently there have been some instances. So, Mr. Chairman, again, I'll give you that. And concerns were raised, and this is a mechanism designed to try to deal with some very, very limited situations. Let me be clear. What the bill does is it allows the feeder to take a superior position, to jump ahead of the lender in terms of getting paid out when that collateral sold. It allows them to jump ahead and get paid for those, as we've agreed to, 45 days of feed that's provided. Now, you can do that today under the existing law if the feeder asks the lender and the lender agrees to that. But that exists in the law today. What this will do is simply say, you don't have to ask, you simply have to tell. It's tell them that you're putting the feed out there, tell the lender the feed's going out, and you've got a lien. You got to perfect the lien in 60 days, but the lien exists there. And what this really creates for lenders is a concern about what's next. And I want to raise that right here and now. Where does the next priority lien jump ahead of us? There are a number of liens in this particular statute. The vets, the feeders, the breeders all have a superior position simply because that's the way the law puts it. And I want to raise that as an issue of concern to lenders as we come before the committee. Mr. Schoenfeld's right. Mr. Chairman, you're right. We've spent a good bit of time working on this since it was introduced to us about 6 weeks ago. A number of changes have been made so that while we don't support this bill, we're not going to sit here and oppose this bill either. I think there are a couple of other changes, members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, that a couple of my colleagues will bring forward that you might give consideration to. But I wanted to raise those items not just for today but for the future in case others of these come forward. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate your work on this and the discussions we've had. And again, I would emphasize what you said. This is hopefully a rare instance. Contrary, you're right. The feed mill does not anymore have to. They can just simply inform you that they're taking a position and go ahead. I would suggest most of them will still come to the bank and work with our banks and say, we'll continue delivering feed. Can we send you the bill and still have that agreement? And most banks would agree to that. The only time this would kick in is if for some reason a bank said, no, we're not laying out any more cash for this, and get in line with everyone else. And at that point, you know, I think it's going to be rare, but I hope, contrary to that, that there's still feed mills, farmers, and bankers are still working together to make sure we're getting cash payments for those deliveries as they occur during that 45 days.
Mr. Chairman, we're all in this business of agriculture together.
Yeah.
Make sure that happens.
Any questions for Mr. Appetz?
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA represents about 94% of the banks in Minnesota, large and small, all across the state. First of all, I too want to thank the chair and for availing himself and his staff to work on this legislation, and he's been very open with us from the lending community and everyone to make himself available to work on these issues, again, with his staff too, so we appreciate that. And we also want to thank you and others to work together to narrow the legislation. I think there were some questions up front about what this would apply to. It appears to have been narrowed considerably to certain circumstances, and we very much appreciate that. We do still have a couple concerns, and it's been raised here a couple times, and I'll echo it again. Mr. Appetz raised it, and I think the chair did, and others maybe did too. It's not really in our interest to allow livestock to starve. It's just not in the lender's interest. It's our collateral. It's our community. It's you know, our customers, etc. I mean, so it's just not in our interest. So there really isn't an incentive per se for us to allow that to starve, as mentioned. So I just want to state that for the record. That's the first thing every one of my members has brought to my attention when I brought this forward. As Mr. Appetz mentioned, the lien priority issue is one that we take very seriously in the banking industry. while this may be narrow, what's next, as Mr. Appet said, and I would echo those comments, we would have a concern about that. And then to a specific question I've had, and I've chatted with the proponents of this, we talk about this being during the 45 days following mediation, and I'm just kind of, and I'm not a mediation expert by any means, but sometimes a mediation may take less than 45 days. I'm just kind of wondering if you could say something to the effect of 45 days or whenever the mediation, whatever is less, or somehow, just to be clear what that means.
And the way I understood it, and Mr. Schoenfeld, I think, did a good job, as soon as that mediation agreement kicks in, it could be 30 days, it could be 35 days, it could be 25 days, then a whole new set of rules automatically takes effect that we already have on the book. So this only allows up to 45 days, in which case we think mediation will start, and the good faith rules and other things that are already on the books kick in. So by default, we really don't have to define that because it's already there once that mediation agreement's perfected. The way I understand it, and again, Mr. Schoenfeld's kind of nodding his head over there, so you are covered on that, so it doesn't extend out past any point where the bank will be sitting there with the mediators and others. If anything, hopefully it will help to expedite that mediation, knowing that some of these things are happening, to get everyone in the room and get those agreements as early as possible.
Okay. Well, and that was just the end. That was my last point for the day, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, we thank you for coming, and we do appreciate and work as hard as we can to coordinate all these things with our banks. And, again, I assume this is rare, and I certainly don't consider it, at least with this committee or me, a nose under the camel's tent for anything beyond. I mean, this is really just keeping the animal welfare issue out of our realm. We don't want the cameras and PETA to be showing up at anyone's farm or anyone's bank, and this kind of sets that aside as one of those issues if it happens. So any questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or do you have a question? Representative Tremba.
Thank you. I'm not going to support this, so I'm going to do that in ahead. So.
Okay. Mr. Skilbred. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Skilbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, a statewide association of privately held, locally committed community banks. And also, my banks, as you know, are 80% of them or so are located in rural Minnesota. So they are primary ag lenders and therefore very interested in this bill. Likewise, I'd like to thank Chairman Junkie and his staff and Mr. Schoenfeld and others for working with us on this bill. We've been having a number of discussions right up until in the hallway a few minutes ago on this legislation. The combination of the A1 and the D2 amendment, I think, takes this bill forward and narrows the scope. And so I want to thank you for those changes that have been made. I want to add what some other folks have said, though, and including the chairman. We believe this is a very rare circumstance that this is occurring. And therefore, while we share the concerns about what ifs, you know, we do want to bring up the question of, do we really need this bill? We question that, number one. Number two, we want to point out that if this is, you know, the circumstance, again, is the circumstance of a mediation taking place. So we have, you know, the facts on the table are that we have at least one troubled loan that has triggered the foreclosure, but probably multiple troubled loans or loans that are in question, probably from multiple creditors. So that is the context, number one. Number two, our lenders are going to very, very likely be one of the creditors that is at the table for this situation. And we firmly believe that the assumption should be that if the lender believes the best decision is to release funds for the feed, the lender is going to do that. Now, there might be an exception someplace. We understand that. And maybe they arise because of very unusual circumstances. But we do believe that the assumption that we make, anyway, is that if it's in the best interest of the situation for a fee to be delivered and paid for by the lender. We believe that we will do that. If we do not believe it's the right thing to do, and if the suppliers want to take on that responsibility, we believe that it ought to be at their risk. And likewise, in the case of previous comments, you know, the question for us again and also is, if this exception is made, what other exception is going to be next? So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll conclude my comments and be available for questions.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Chair Junkie. I have a question for Mr. Schoenfeld, if we could bring him back up.
You bet. Anything for Mr. Skillbred before he leaves? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skillbred, what is the position of the independent community bankers on this bill, then?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do not support the bill.
Okay. Now, Mr. Torkelson, Mr. Schoenfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's my understanding that this is really to take care of a very rare situation, but there are some examples where this has happened. You know, it depends on who's involved, which lenders are involved, but it benefits all of us to avoid a situation where we have a building full of dead animals. It reflects on the entire ag community. I'd just like a little more information from Mr. Schoenfeld regarding the issue.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I can add a little bit to that. We had a survey done by the state mediator on mediations as to how many mediators felt that there was a problem or what was the scope of a problem. And I'm sitting here saying, yes, it is rare, but the mediators that responded to the survey were about 15% of them felt that they had difficulties making sure that feed was continued during a mediation. So that they had, in about 15% of the mediations that were involved with livestock, there were difficulties in sorting out how that feed would continue to flow into the mediation. And that's once the mediation has started. This is a period prior to the time when there isn't as many rules as the chairman had indicated. Secondly, it is not always, it is true that a bank or a credit source makes a decision, and they do make a decision. And basically, if their decision is that we're not going to pay for any more feed, what we're asking them to do through this legislation is to get out of the way and let somebody else do it. That is their decision. Nobody's asking them to continue paying for it if they don't feel it's in their best interest to do so. The other thing is that recognize that we had, with regard to the pork producers, we had about four situations last summer in which we were contacted by producers in which they said, you know, my feeders are empty and the bank won't release funds and the feed mill won't bring it and so forth. What do I do? And quite frankly, the resolution to it was where the president or the head of the pork producers called up the bank and said, which channel 9, channel 11, or channel 4 would you like ahead of your bank tomorrow morning? You know, talking about these animals. One of the problems you've got today is that we are now in a situation in which there are large amounts of animals in a given area. I mean, you can have a building with 2,000 head of hogs in it, or you can have a feedlot of cattle or a turkey barn or whatever it is that has got a lot of animals, so that this becomes magnified in that kind of sense. So that's also an issue here. And so even if the numbers are not great, the effect of even one operation can be considerable. The other point I'd point out here is that there is in the existing law, and it doesn't change with this bill, a provision, and I'll read it. It says, if a lender responds with a letter of commitment for part or all of the amount in the lien notification statement, the supplier may not obtain a lien to the amount stated in the letter of commitment. If you read in the bill itself, it speaks about the fact that it is only unpaid feed during the 45-day period, only unpaid feed. So if the creditor or the lender determines that it's in their best interest to continue to pay the bill, the lien never takes effect. It's a non-issue. So I guess that's the best way I can answer your question.
Okay. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, out of those four that you were talking about, those four instances, how many of those were in mediation?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, in those particular cases, I'm not sure that they worked the mediation in those particular cases, but I can't honestly answer that. I can tell you that I was informed that we had four that contacted us about it, and I guess I'd never been asked the question, and I hadn't gone to that. The reason that we went to the mediation situation here is because it was my intent in looking at this to be the most narrow situation that we could apply it to, and those that were in the worst situation. And the very fact that they're in mediation means that they're in the worst situation. Now, one of the other parts of this bill is that it applies to both mandatory and to voluntary mediation. So if that situation were there, one of the things that may happen, even if they weren't in mediation, is that at that point the farmer would request mediation in order to be part of the situation of getting the livestock fed.
Ms. Welty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, I was asking that just to figure out if this bill is addressing a specific instance that we know of that actually occurred. And from what I'm gathering is it does not. Is there anyone who has an example of someone being in mediation where the feed wasn't being delivered?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I indicated with my first statement, 15% of the mediators indicated that that was the case in mediations that they were involved in with livestock. So although I can't give you which specific farm it was, I can tell you that 15% of the mediators responded that that, in fact, had been the case.
Representative Will.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, you know, I heard about this bill, and I've been reading the information that's been distributed, but then I start thinking of the unintended consequences, and just one thing that comes to mind is if we put this in place, is this going to end up, you know, there are some banks that are just going to say, you know, you're too far into it, it's time that the livestock gets shipped and the livestock gets sold, and we're going to take our loss. And now with this in place, it could force more into mediation because they know that at least the feed will get paid for, and therefore there's going to be more debt, you know, that's going to be incurred on the banks and on the elevators. So I do you see that as a possibility of an unintended consequence of this legislation going through?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely I do not. And the reason for it is, first of all, no farmer that I would know is going to request mediation unless they've got a serious problem. And first of all, if you remember the discussion that took place here by the state mediator, during one of your earlier hearings, it was commented, I believe, and I may be wrong on these numbers, I think maybe the person from the feed and grain had indicated this, that there were approximately 500 mediations last year, 500 and some mediations, half of those were livestock. I don't see that changing at all. I mean, that's a situation that is prompted by the bank. It's not prompted by the farmer. It is the bank that requests the mediation. Or bank requests the foreclosure, and then the mediation takes place because of state law. So it doesn't change that at all. In terms of the voluntary mediations, there were only two last year. I cannot believe that somebody's going to go into a mediation specifically for the purpose of this, because their farm plan would be ended. I don't really understand why it would force anything more than what you've got. I don't see where that why would a farmer try to get protected for 45 days worth of feed by entering into a mediation agreement that's going to tell all of his creditors that he's got a big problem? I don't know why that would happen.
Representative Brown, and then Szymanski, and then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me an idea of what kind of dollars we're even talking about? And I know we've got a range of farm sizes and a range of hogs that we're talking about, but, you know, up to a 45-day period, how much money are we really talking about?
So, Mr. Schoenfeld, on that $88 hog, how many dollars would be a 45-day at the maximum feed bill?
Probably in that particular case, if I actually used a 45-day, I guess I'd be thinking maybe, if you averaged it out, maybe $20 a hog. And that would be assuming you were buying all the feed. If you were feeding your own corn, it would be much less than that. Okay. And I can't speak to, I guess I can't speak to other species, but.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be a more appropriate question for one of the lenders in the room, but in reading this, the input lien is for the unpaid retail cost of the livestock production input. So my question would be, does the feed supplier, if you will, or the input supplier, is he, you know, eligible for 100% reimbursement when the other lien holders may get less than 100% in the final mediation?
Mr. Chairman, nothing in this bill, first of all, changes any of the priorities that exist within the liens. And if you read into the statute, there are four, actually ends up in fourth place amongst existing priorities. There are three that come ahead of this lien. One is the number one is the veterinarian's lien. Veterinarians basically get paid the first dollar is out of the chute no matter what. Secondly, there is a feeder lien, which is basically a contractor's lien for somebody that is feeding animals and they get so much ahead to feed them, and that it basically is a feeder lien. The third one is a breeder's lien, so that if somebody has participated in you know, like artificial insemination or those kinds of things, that comes ahead of it. And then a fourth one would be other ag input suppliers lien if they're secured. Because an ag input supplier lien goes to those people that file UCCs first. So in the case of where a person brought forth an ag input supplier lien and they requested of the bank, even a feed situation where they requested of the bank under the existing statute and they said, will you give us opportunity to get ahead of you? If the bank said yes, we'll give you a letter of commitment, we'll make sure it's paid, then this doesn't exist. But if they didn't, and for some reason the bank did not respond, as an example, after 10 days, then the feed dealer or anybody else would be able to get an ag input supplier lien, which, because it would be filed first, would be ahead of this lien as well. And I think I've covered it pretty much at that point as to the people that might be ahead of it. In the end, the mediation, you might be a little misunderstanding of mediation in the sense that mediation is just that. It's not arbitration. So the mediation is an agreement between all parties as to who will get paid. It's not regulated by law that somebody gets paid and somebody else doesn't. It's a mediation in which they work it out amongst all the parties involved.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, you mentioned up to 15% of mediation cases had problems or situations with this, but I don't recall any stories of a barn full of dead pigs. So what happened in some of those situations, and is it really a significant problem?
15%. Well, Mr. Chairman, there actually have been some stories over the few years in which animals have not been properly fed. Now, there may be a number of reasons for that. But, you know, recognize that with regard to this bill, if in fact they are being fed, this bill has no effect at all, because the temporary lien does not go into effect if in fact they are continuing to be paid for and fed with regard to the lender. So, you know, I can tell you that there have been cases in which we've been concerned, or we wouldn't bother bringing this ahead of you, that it's moving in that direction. And as you get more and more situations, you're going to find if everything are good times and hogs are $70, nobody's going to get into this situation. It's when you're in bad times, and it's only in those situations that we're asking for the mediation. I know that the feed dealers would like to see this across the board. The pork producers don't support that because they think it would cause too much havoc with regard to lending. The other thing I would mention to you, and I was just handed from my friends with the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, that both Farm Bureau and Farmers Union also support this legislation. And in talking with Tom Peterson, for instance, of the Farmers Union, and responding to Representative Welty,
they said that they had a couple of dairy situations in which this occurred. I'm not privy to that as firsthand information, but he passed that on to me, that they had a couple of dairy situations in which occurred.
Okay. Well, members, again, I think it is a good safeguard. We have had a tough year or two with some of our livestock operations, and this is really a safeguard, you know, not for the farm family, certainly, but mainly for the livestock. I mean, to get it out and get it done. And again, as Mr. Schoenfeld and others said, nothing happens if the feed bill is being paid. And I trust most of our bankers will be paying the feed bill. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, is this going to Commerce or to some other committee next?
This is being laid over for possible inclusion in a bill that we may put together in a few weeks. So we won't be voting on it today, but we want to get the hearing done today because, as you can see, it takes kind of lengthy time, and we want to get that out front. So if there's no more questions, we will lay this bill aside for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, again, update on financial stuff. We continue to work with the finance chair and leadership on numbers. We don't have them yet. We continue to work with our fiscal staff, digging through the couch cushions. As soon as I know something, we'll certainly want to gather members offline. From both sides of the aisle to talk about some possible situations moving forward. But we're hearing the Senate's putting together bills right now with some fairly, I'd say, draconian cuts to agriculture at this point. So that's this afternoon, if anyone's, or Thursday. So if you're curious, track that hearing and see what goes on. But as of now, I'm leaving next week kind of open at this point to see if we have any work on budgets, and we'll go from there. I it's about as much as I know right now. So any questions to that and where we're at? All right. Thank you, members. It was a good day. Meeting's adjourned.